And so with that, we're going to have Mac. He's going to share a word with us today. I love Mac. He's such a good teacher. You guys, give him a warm welcome and let him feel good this morning.
Good morning. How y'all doing? All right. So, been going through Luke. I unfortunately can't be here on Wednesday nights because I work an evening job, and I was really excited to have, I would have loved to have been here this last Wednesday when Jason went through the healing of the leper, because, man, that's just, it's kind of an awesome story. I mean, I never look at a miracle of Jesus or a healing of Jesus as just what's on the surface. There's always something deeper that goes to that. You know, when Jesus made water into wine and the people at the wedding said, "Now this is the good stuff," reminds me of, you know, Jesus doesn't just give you enough to get by. He wants to give you not just life. He doesn't want to give you survival. He wants to give you abundant life. He gives you the good stuff. He gives you the strong stuff, you know. So when he was healing that leper, the first thing that kind of came into my mind of that was, man, here is this guy who, for whoever knows, an indeterminate amount of time, years probably, wasn't allowed to be around other people except other lepers, except other damaged people. In fact, he would have to yell out, "Unclean, unclean, unclean. I can't, don't come near me, because I don't want you to catch this." And then the first thing that Jesus has him do, he's like, "No, just keep it on the DL, keep it down low. Go to the priest." And if I were that leper, I'd be like, "This is the guy I'm not allowed to be around for like years. You want me to approach that guy?" There had to be such emotional turmoil in that leper at that time to be like, "All right, first off, I want to shout and scream and praise and like woohoo everything, because now I can be around my friends, I can be around my family, I can have a life again. But the first thing you want me to do is confront this fear of going to see the priest, the guy that I couldn't be around and probably very likely sat in the greatest amount of judgment of me." But God said, Jesus said, "Go tell him, make your offering." There had to be so much inside him that he had to confront emotionally, so many fears, so many, you know, when you're a certain way for a certain amount of time, it starts to become your identity, you know? And this guy had to have, at some point, not seen himself as Joe Schmo, you know, a merchant, a father, a husband, or he saw himself as a leper. And the exact opposite of the leper was the priest, the most clean, the guy who went into the Holy of Holies, the guy who came close to God, who was most pure on the earth with the most dirty. And God said, Jesus said, "See him first." Man, I don't know if I'd be like, "Can I see my wife first? Love to see my kids." And he's like, "No, that's what you're going to do. I healed you. You're going to be a testimony. The first place you're going to be a testimony is overcoming that greatest fear that you would have had, that the greatest conflict that you would have had." And so that kind of leads us into this, right? And as I said, we start to identify ourselves by all these different labels that we kind of have. And so I thought I would start out by telling you that today we are going to read the Gospel of the Carpenter as interpreted by the physician and presented by the PE teacher. And I love to sit up there and listen to the gospel of the carpenter as interpreted by the physician and presented by a pet groomer. And I love to sit up here and listen to it as interpreted by an electrician as well. So if we can get those labels out of the way to realize that there's certain things that God has for you in this life that goes far beyond the labels that you have adopted for yourself. You understand? So I spent some time in Asia Minor. I spent 6 years there. And the image, the labels are so daggone important to people there. It is, you think it's strong here. There, it's like, doesn't matter what your job is. Are you educated or uneducated? Are you of a high caste or of a low caste? Doesn't matter what you, doesn't. Here in America, we have this beautiful concept of, you know, some guy can open up a fruit stand in the 1800s to build into an empire of five different businesses for his grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and he can make something of himself. And you go over to this part of the world, and what you're born into, really, that's it. It's what your grandfather did. It's what your father did. It's what his father did. That's it. That's all you're accomplishing in life. And so Jesus, being born to a carpenter, spent the first 30 years as a carpenter. And so he begins his ministry, carpenter, goes out into the wilderness, tempted by the devil, and then starts his ministry. And here we have a physician, an educated man, following that carpenter and recording it for us to read today. Seems odd that a physician would be following a carpenter, right? Maybe there's something more. This I like to call the beginning of Bread and Miracle Jesus. Bread and Miracle Jesus is the most popular Jesus in the world. People love Bread and Miracle Jesus. Yeah. I mean, if Mattel was selling 3-inch figurines, action figures of Jesus, for number one would be Bread and Miracle Jesus. He'd be the most popular. You'd want to buy 3 of them, one to play with, one to keep in the pack, one to pass on to the grandkids, right? Next would be Baby Jesus. We all love Baby Jesus, right? We don't necessarily like Jesus driving people out of the temple, and we don't necessarily like Jesus confronting me of my sins, and we don't necessarily like Jesus saying, you know, get away from me. But we love Bread and Miracle Jesus. And if we begin, we're going to start out in verse 15 of chapter 5, where you can see people love Bread and Miracle Jesus because the word had spread about this leper healing. And people are like, oh, there's Bread and Miracle Jesus. He's going to be in town. I'm going to go check it out. And I kind of see it as, all right, okay, confession. When I'm driving, and I kind of like being in a small town again because I don't have to deal with traffic, but you know when you're driving and there's this huge backup on the highway and you get to a point and realize it was just like a car that had gone off the side of the road or something like that. Nobody's injured. Nobody's, you know, just a little minor fender bender. And you go, that was it? That's what kept me. And it wasn't even on my side of the road. It was on the other side of the road. And everybody's just like the rubbernecking of they've got to slow down to watch, right? People love the spectacle. And Bread and Miracle Jesus, he became a spectacle, right? Word spread. This leper, incurable disease. Incurable disease. Some guy, some carpenter out from Nazareth cured a leper. Right? So there's no hype man. Jesus doesn't employ a hype man. And the fact that we like to interpret the Bible as Jesus is American, right? This is how I know Jesus isn't an American, because in America, we have people who accomplish nothing but still have hype men so they can have reality shows. Right? They're untalented. They nothing about them that's worth watching, but you can watch their vapid shopping excursions every single week on whatever channel it's going to be on, right? We can see how real the housewives are. We can keep up with the Kardashians. We can see all of that. And they got all their hype men, right? And there's nobody hyping up Jesus. Remember, he's just basically called his disciples. And they were fishermen. They weren't necessarily, you know, media arts students. You didn't have anybody going, Sunday, 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 come see Jesus who healed the leper. We'll sell you the whole seat, but you're only going to need the edge, right? It wasn't like that. He had no hype, man. It was just word of mouth. And what is Jesus' reaction? If we go to verse 15, it says, yet news spread about him all the more so that the crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus often withdrew to the lonely places and prayed. So Jesus not only didn't have the hype man, he did the opposite of what a hype man is supposed to do. The crowds come. He's not out shaking hands and kissing babies and running for re-election. He's out there going, let me get off on my own. Right? I don't know that I have that strength. I love people loving me. You know? Like, oh, you're so awesome. You're so great. You're so wonderful. And I'm just like, no. It's you know, right? We love that. We love when people are praising us. And here is God with us, Emmanuel, on the earth, going off to escape people's praises. And I speculate about what happened. People have been speculating about Jesus' alone time for about 2,000 years now. And so there's a few things that I like to speculate about, especially in this situation. Number one, Jesus had to have withdrawn. So I'm assuming the first thing in his mind is he's got to pray. He's got to get with his Father. He's got to figure out what's going on, who he should be, where he's got to be, what the Father wants of him, seeking the Lord's will. I think that's a given, and I don't think there's anybody in the last 2,000 years who didn't make the assumption that when Jesus went off on his own that he was praying. I think also that there had to have been a time of reflection, because remember, the temptation he was given in that wilderness, that temptation was the devil saying, you can have all of this. And now he had that first mirror, that first healing, and he had the people. He had the people. They were coming into the palm of his hands. And so there had to be a temptation for a little bit of taste of what Satan had tempted him with. And I think Jesus had to get away from that and say, I'm here for my Father's business. Let me make sure I'm refocusing, redefining what I'm here for. What's the vision? What's the master plan? What is that all about? Right? But I also think that Jesus had to get alone to prepare for what was next. He started to see crowds are coming, people are coming. How does he handle this? What's his next step? How is he going to regroup? Because, you know, if you're in the middle of it, if you're in the midst of it, it is really hard to figure out your next step when you're just in the middle of it. And so Jesus made it his custom, and we'll see throughout the gospel that Jesus made it his custom to get off alone, spend time with God, regroup, figure things out. And that was really important. If it's important for him, it's important for us as well. You know, how often are we tithing of our time to get alone, refocus that relationship we have with God, figuring out who we are as fathers and husbands and wives and mothers and workers and whatnot? How often are we getting alone with God to figure out, God, you've given me this position, and I have influence in other people's lives. What do you want me to do with that? And I really think that when Jesus got alone, that's really where he was at, was I'm becoming a person of influence. What should I do about that? How do you want me to do with that? I mean, there's a lot of things I'd love to do as a person of influence, but most of it would glorify myself. And that wasn't what Jesus was about. He was here to glorify his Father in heaven. So now we move into, there's this house, right? Jesus is teaching at the house. Miracle man has come to town. He's just sitting in a house. Notice he's not in a church. He's not in a temple. He's not at the synagogue. He got invited to some guy's house. And this poor guy, who I think about, this sucker of a guy, you know, he's like thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to have Jesus over. Maybe he was the hype man, maybe going, hey, you know who's coming to my house? You know that guy that healed the leper? Yeah, he's going to be at my house this Sunday. Why don't you come on over to my house? And he ended up with a crowd out the door, right? And now the houses, as I've seen in this area, and I'm not sure because I haven't really been in Jerusalem, but in other Asian areas, people's houses are not like in America. Here you buy a plot of land, right? And a portion of that land you assume is going to be for barbecues and cookouts and kids playing in the yard and things like that, right? And then Asia, they don't do that. They put a wall around every inch that they can, and they will build their house as big as the plot of land can go, right? And some of the older houses, basically, that wall, a majority of it is a courtyard because a lot of the life would be lived outside. And I've been to a home where these people had like a cow in the courtyard because they had fresh milk. And that was a kind of a strange thing. I was, as an American, and you drink your homogenized and pasteurized milk, and all of a sudden I have this guy saying, hey, would you like some milk? And he goes to a cow to get his milk. Now, I'm really happy it wasn't a goat, but I was scared. I was like, and in that part of the world, they love to mix their fresh milk with Sprite, which is honestly not bad. They call it dude soda. So in verse 17, it says, one day, Jesus was teaching, and Pharisees and teachers of the law were sitting there. And they had come from every village in Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem. And the power of the Lord was with Jesus to heal the sick. Now, not only had word spread for the common folk, but these Pharisees and teachers of the law were coming from all over to also be present. Now, have you ever worked or had someone in your family that you know was just waiting for you to mess up? Like, on you all the time. You do A, and they ask why you didn't do B. Right? You know those people? You ever lived with that? I've had two people like that in my life. I've had two people, and it is so frustrating. It is so stressful. Where there's nothing you can do that's actually right, even if it's the right thing. They start asking you questions, why didn't you do that? And then, like, as you're doing it, they've got to be right here. They got to be watching you. They're going to be criticizing you. You know, like, as soon as they're around, like, the hairs on your neck start to go up, and you start to get a little hunchbacked and stuff like that, right? So I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt and say there were probably Pharisees and teachers of the law that were here to observe and check things out. But let's be realistic. The majority of those Pharisees were kind of like Pharisees were staunch believers in the scriptures, and they thought that, and they were staunch followers of the scriptures, and they were really happy with you as long as you followed the scriptures exactly the way that they did. When your interpretation of God was their exact interpretation of God, then we could be friends. But the moment you had anything wrong, legalism stepped in, and we would start to argue the minutiae of little things, right? There's a lot of Christians that might as well be Pharisees. Like, there's a lot of things that this church and church down the street and even the Catholic church and even that church, we can agree on, right? It's called orthodoxy, right? There are Christian orthodox ideas. There are things that all churches can agree upon, right? There are also some minutiae, some differences. And for those of you that are wondering why America has like 47,000 different denominations of churches, it's because at some point somebody said, I agree with 90% of what you're saying, but I don't agree with this 10%. So we're just going to go over here and start a whole new church, right? And it's kind of interesting to me. I didn't realize this until I went out of the country. When you go to a country where Christianity is not the major religion, it's amazing how well Christians get along with one another. And if you want to flip the script, in America here, because I'll just tell you my experience is living in a Muslim country. In America here, can you tell the difference between Muslims? Muslims here get along. It doesn't matter if they're Shia. It doesn't matter if they're Sunni. They get along. They're fine. They have no problem with one another here. But you get to a country where Islam is the major religion, and Shias and Sunnis really don't get along. I think it's human nature. Here in America, Pentecostals have differences with Baptists, who have differences with Catholics, who have differences with Lutherans, who have differences with Orthodox. They have different. We have all these little minutiae that we get caught up in, and that's honestly because at some point there was someone Pharisaical that kind of said, "What you're doing is mostly right, but not quite right. So we're going to make a church that does things the way that we agree with, that we do." And if you get to a country where Christianity isn't the major religion, you'd be surprised how often Pentecostals get together with Catholics and have absolutely no problem with one another. Can you imagine Pentecostals and Catholics getting together here? It's like, you're trying to think it would be like unbelievable here. But there, I mean, I had a Catholic assistant. She was a wonderful young lady. And somebody tried to get on her about how she wasn't worshiping Jesus the right way, and she came up to me one day and she goes, "I love Jesus. What's the problem?" She's like, "I have a relationship with Jesus. What's the problem?" You know? And therein is like the Pharisaical attitude. And these guys were sitting there going, you know, they're sitting there like bean counters. They're sitting there with a little abacus or whatever in their mind. We sit with a little calculator in our mind. How many things does this person say that I disagree with? And that was the Pharisaical attitude, right? Jesus knew these guys were here, right? These guys have been appearing everywhere he teaches. So he knew they would be there. So he shows up and, you know, reputation of the guy who healed the leper is there. So he kind of shows up, and now we have, it says, "And the power of the Lord was with Jesus to heal the sick." In verse 18, it says, "Some men came carrying a paralyzed man on a mat and tried to take him into the house to lay before Jesus." And this may very, very well have been trying to even get him in the courtyard of that home. They couldn't do it. It was so overcrowded, right? When they could not find a way to do this because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and lowered him on his mat through the tiles into the middle of the crowd right in front of Jesus. So here's this guy. He's paralyzed, can't do anything for himself. He has these buddies that say, "You know what? We're going to get you to the guy that healed the leper. We're going to take you to Jesus." All right? Can't go through the crowd, can't surf you over the top of the crowd, but you know what? Here's some stairs going up to the roof. We can get you up there. They get him up to the roof. And there were a couple of different ways to do the roofing in that day and in that time, the most expensive of which would be these terracotta tiles. So we know that this man spent some real coin to get a nice roof on his house. And these, and the way that the terracotta tiles were done is they were just kind of overlapped one another. They weren't, you, obviously you couldn't nail them in, right? So they were just kind of overlapped onto one another. So if you just started pulling, if you got one loose, you could get a whole bunch loose like scales on a fish and just start undoing the tiles, big enough hole to let this guy down on his mat. Some guy who spent a lot of money on his roof sat there and saw all his roof being taken apart and some guy being lowered down. I would love to see what happened after Jesus left, but that's not in my Bibles. I don't know. But I'd imagine, I hope the guy was like, hey, praise Jesus. You know, somebody was healed. You know, I got the coin to replace my roof. Praise Jesus. But, you know, I also am a man, and it doesn't matter what I can replace. I don't even like people coming to my house and eating my food, you know, much less taking my roof apart. So I'm sure that guy had a little struggle. There's nothing in my Bible to tell me about that man, so I can't really spend some time focusing on him. But I wonder about him. I do wonder. I see, besides Jesus, four different people in this story. The first person is the handicapped man. And some of us need to be aware of our handicap, because our handicap may not be physical, may very well be emotional, may be a fear that holds us. It might be a bitterness that holds us. There is something within us as broken human beings, in all of us, that handicaps us, that keeps us from that life abundant. This handicapped man, he had no choice but to expose his handicap to the rest of the world. He couldn't. He probably would have made a living by begging, maybe at the gates of the city or at the gates of the temple. He probably made his living that way. And there was no way to hide his handicap. But here, in our day, we get to hide our handicaps all the time. You know, we hide inabilities behind anger. We hide fear behind bravado. We hide, we'll hide anger behind a smile. And doesn't that define our culture very closely? Isn't that who we are as Americans today? You know, you ever been down south and they'll tell you, oh, bless your heart. Well, really what they want to say is, you piece of, right? And how many times have we been that person, right? How many times have you said, I'm going to fake it till I make it? You know, life ain't good right now, but I'm just going to pretend it is until everybody around me believes it is, right? And you get so caught up in playing that character that the hurt never gets addressed and your handicap just festers and becomes worse and worse and totally ingrained, to the point of now we have people taking probably the most prescription psychotropic drugs at any time of our history. And that's the prescription ones. That's not even counting the ones that we're taking over the counter or at the liquor store or over at the dispensary that we can get without having to have a prescription. Right? Living a lie, who I am on the outside versus who I am on the inside, paralyzes us just as much as this man who had no choice but to display the fact that he was paralyzed. His legs didn't work. There's nothing he could do about that. But some of us, our hearts don't work. Our souls don't work. Our brains don't work because of the paralyzation that already exists within us of trying to live two different ways. You know, some of us have this group of friends over here and we're person A with them, and we got to be person B with this group of friends. Sometimes you got my Christian world I live in and praise Jesus, hallelujah, and then I've got my non-Christian friends and yeah, I'll have another, right? Just trying to fit in. We are such a hurting and broken people that sometimes we don't even want to admit or we don't even realize the paralyzations that are within us, that are killing us each and every day. But here is a man, not only brave enough to say, I'm paralyzed, I need something, nothing's working, my legs are dead. The doctor is the one recording this. So the doctor has verified, I am paralyzed. I am not walking again. I can't do it on my own. Thank God I've got these friends. And I think what keeps us paralyzed today is a lot of us don't have friends like this guy did. Jason, we were talking about masculinity a couple weeks ago. Men, how many of you have friends like this? How many of you have friends that you say, I need something, I'll be there? You have friends like that today? Test. Hey, I'm moving. Who's going to show up with their truck? Right? You know, I need a ride to the airport at 3 a.m. Who's there? Right? Don't worry, it's only in Eugene. Right? This guy had the most amazing friends, and they're the second people in that story. Right? So not only, A, do I think I need to recognize what's paralyzed me, but B, I need to not only find men like this, friends like this, but I need to be a man like that and be a friend like that. Right? How many of us sit there and go, there's no one like that in my life. I don't have anyone that would do that for me. And then somebody asks you to do something, you're like, well, I don't have anyone in my life that does that, so why should I do that? Right? There is a two-edged sword in these friends. And honestly, these friends are the main focus of this story in my life, in my opinion. These friends are the guys that not only do I want in my life, but they're the type of person I need to be in other people's lives, right? This is the type of community. This is what Jesus is talking about. This is, you know, when we are going to do communion later, that's only a symbol of being men like this, being a woman like that, being a friend like that. When you're taking communion, you're saying, I'm going to join in with all of you and be a person like that with you. That's what the church is about. That's what the community is about. Being these men that'll say, you know what? I mean, how many of you are the friend that says, oh man, it's kind of crowded. Well, we tried. You know, good luck. I'm going to put you right here. I bet you can probably beg for some money because you got a huge crowd, man. You can probably get some good coin today, right? I guarantee you, there's people that would be like, yeah, here. But he didn't. Not only did he not have one friend like that, but he had several. I'm guessing at least four that had to hold every corner of that mat and hold his weight going down through the hole in the roof, the brand new sunroof that this gentleman had created for him, right? So he not only had one friend like that, but he had at least, I'm going to say, four. Now, sometimes there's that influence of the crowd. You know when, like, a decision has to be made and everybody just kind of sits there silently and we just kind of wait for, we kind of know the right thing, but we kind of know what we really want to do and what we really don't want to do. I kind of imagine that there was some guy that said, hey, stairs go to the roof. I know how to take those tiles off. Who's with me? There had to be at least one guy in that group of four who said that for that to happen. Because I guarantee you there's probably three guys sitting around looking at their sandals going, you know, kind of, I don't know what we're going to, you know. How many of you have a passionate problem solver as a friend in your life? And if you don't, maybe God's calling you to be that passionate problem solver in other people's lives. You know, who's going to sit there and go, yeah, we got stairs, we got roof, these tiles come off easy. I can get them down, no problem. Right? These people are driven, they are motivated, they are awesome friends, and I am not like them. I wish I was. I'll try to be more. But I look at them and I go, I don't know that. I mean, I like some of you. I don't know if I would be thinking of humping up a big old staircase onto a roof and lowering you down. I'd be like, hey, wouldn't it be easier? Let me just give you a couple of bucks for lunch, right? Bystanders are the third people that I want to bring up, because I think the majority of us in this room live our lives as bystanders. You know, the work of Jesus is happening, and how many of us just sit and warm up a chair so that we can see it? You know, Jesus, the reason he had to get alone was not maybe to deal with and to take on the spirit of healing. Maybe that was it. But also, I think he had to deal with the fact that there were going to be an awful lot of people just standing there watching him, not participating, not seeking the Lord, not really being a part of anything, just sitting. And do you want your life to be defined by he or she lived a good life, warmed a pew, took up a seat, accepted Jesus at 19, never did anything with it? There's a lot of people like that. And those people were there. They wanted to see the spectacle of Jesus. They wanted to see bread and miracle Jesus. They would have bought three of those action figures that are bread and miracle Jesus, because that's their favorite kind of Jesus to look at. You'll see later in Scripture where Jesus is like, nope, go away. You know, lead, follow, or get out of the way. What are you going to do? Here's the last group of people there, besides Jesus, those Pharisees. I want to bring that up and kind of close with what the Pharisees were doing there. Remember, we had said that Pharisees are a lot like those people that are just on you, waiting for you to mess up, right? Those Pharisees sat in judgment, watching, because now in verse 21, because I'm old and need bifocals. Verse 21, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began thinking to themselves, who is this fellow that speaks blasphemy? Who forgives sin but God alone? Because Jesus first forgave his sin, right? They answer their own question. Who can forgive sin but God alone? Who can forgive sin but God alone? God alone. That's who can forgive sin. So they're assuming this guy is blasphemous. Now, they're stuck because they are seeing real miracles happen and they can't have him arrested right then and there. They don't want to be looked at as the bad guy. But on the flip side, they're saying, this doesn't jive with what we think, what we believe to be true. This guy can't be the Messiah. He's just a carpenter from Nazareth. This is not right. This flips our script. We can't really wrap our head around this, right? In verse 22, it says, Jesus knew what they were thinking and asked, why are you thinking these things in your hearts? Which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or to say, get up and walk? From the perspective of a physician, both are impossible. What would be easier for you to hear? As you analyze what has paralyzed you, what would be easier for you to hear? Would it be easier for you to hear, your sins are forgiven? Or would it be easier for you to say, for you to hear, stop being afraid? Just be confident. Stop being so mean to people. Right? Which is easier to hear? The heart has to be dealt with first. Because a lot of that is me not feeling acceptable to the people around me. Right? When I know that that relationship has been healed, that vertical relationship with God has been healed, or that horizontal relationship with that person has been healed, then I can go and I can have that conversation, right? Have you ever had that awkward conversation that finally led to forgiveness, and then you could have the conversations that you wanted to have with that person? Right? Jesus knew that. He said, your sins are forgiven. Now get up and walk. Let me take care of that relationship. That relationship that divides you from God. Let's take care of that relationship, and that will heal you. That will help you to start moving forward with strength and power in your life. Right? Verse 24, this is what I'm going to close with, because I I think I, it has a great sense of irony. Jesus says, but I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. So he said to the paralyzed man, I tell you, get up, take your mat, and go home. Immediately he stood up in front of them, took what he had been laying on, and went home praising God. Everyone was amazed and gave praise to God. They were filled with awe and said, we have seen remarkable things today. So all the bystanders were saying, hey, we saw something awesome today. This was amazing. That is awesome. Jesus chose to use the term Son of Man for himself. Now, most Bible teachers will sit there and say, yeah, that's a valid term for the Messiah. Jesus often refers to himself as the Son of Man. All right? This has a little bit of a hiccup for me, because in dealing with people who have said Jesus never claims to be the Son of God, which is untrue because in other scriptures he actually does, they will say, no, he refers to himself as the Son of Man. And these are people who just want to deny the deity of Christ. They want him to be a good man who lived a couple thousand years ago, but they don't want him to have a life that presents conviction for them, right? But the Son of Man not only is a correct term prophesied for the Messiah, who Jesus is. But do you remember back in chapter 4 what the Pharisees called him when they saw him for the first time? They called him Joseph's son. I feel like maybe one or two of those guys that were in the Pharisaical crowd maybe were present there. Maybe the guy that said, hey, isn't this Joseph's kid? Jesus doesn't refer to himself as the Son of God. He refers to himself as the Son of Man. Not only a prophesied name for the Messiah, but in my opinion, also a callback to what these Pharisees referred to him as in the first place. It's like, yeah, I am the Son of Man. Your sins are forgiven. Not only am I the son of Joseph, I am also the son of God. I am also the Messiah. Think about all the ways that Jesus is defining himself just in that one phrase, I am the Son of Man. How do you define yourself? If you are only defining yourself as, I am the person who does this job, or I am the person in this relationship, I am a wife, I am a husband, I am a father. The truth is, you have multiple definitions throughout your day. And like I said, I love to sit and listen to the scriptures as interpreted by a dog groomer or an electrician. Does that mean that their lives are worthless because they're in a dog? I almost said a dog electrician, which would be a whole new field for me. Does it matter? Are they unusable? No. They are used in a glorious way by God to present the scriptures to people. Son of Man, yeah. Joseph's kid, carpenter, how you doing? Also Messiah. Right? Hi, dog groomer. Also pastor of Ark Bible Church. How you doing? Hi, I'll install your electrical system, but I'll also invite you to Ark Bible Church where you can see me play the drums. Right? How are we defining ourselves throughout the week? Are we defining ourselves as a defeated, handicapped person who can't be in right relationship with people, who can do nothing but beg, whether it be spiritually, emotionally, or physically, for other people's attention and other people's relationship? Is that how we're defining ourselves? Are we defining ourselves as that person that will step up and help another human being? That will go the extra mile, dig a hole in the roof, go put a fence in for somebody, help them move, help them this, help them that, and also talk to them when there were marriages on the rocks and they don't know where to go, what to do, who to turn to? Will we be the person that sits in judgment of how you're doing it wrong and you're doing it wrong and you're doing it wrong? Just look at me because I do it right all the time. Is that how I define myself? Jesus defined himself by calling himself the Son of Man. He defined himself in three different ways. Not only did he address every person in that crowd, including the Pharisees, including the man who was healed and his friends, but he identified the love of God that was on that place. When Jesus saw those Pharisees, that 30-year-old carpenter had to be like, ah, right? If I were a 30-year carpenter and these guys have been studying the law their entire lives, I'd be like, well, we'll see what happens, right? But on the flip side, Jesus was also Emmanuel. He was God made man on earth, to which God made man on earth must have been looking at these Pharisees like, oh, look at these little 4-year-olds playing church. Isn't that cute? They have such a limited understanding. They have no concept of how great and mighty and wonderful the God that they think they're worshiping actually is. So Jesus lives in this dichotomy of the anxiety of a man, but the mentality of a God. And he got to look at these people in both of those ways. And he looks at you in that way too. How are you defining yourself is not as important as how Jesus defines you. Because Jesus calls you healed and saved. He calls you good and faithful servant. He calls you son and daughter. He calls you so many things that you refuse to take on for yourself because of the handicaps that you have already put into your lives. That we've put in there ourselves. We've lived in. Whether it be we got it from our parents or we took it on ourselves. We live in those handicaps. Meanwhile, Jesus, who can define himself three different ways with one statement, calls you so many other better things. You just need to make the understanding of, yeah, maybe I did mess up. Maybe I do have that in my past. But I'm Jesus's, and he says I'm good. And that's what matters. I mean, I got a lot of, well, to use the Marvel Universe, I got a lot of red ink. Some of you have more than me. Some of you don't realize how red my ink can get, right? But we all have that. It's manifested in different ways. Church kids grow up with red ink. Just because you didn't grow up in the church doesn't mean you got it all figured out, right? I think that's going to be my close. I'm going to ask Jason to come up here.